Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
Shit, dude. She just hit you in your face. Shit, dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She's like you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. What I say is over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it.
Let's go across the street.
Now, who got some
money? Look, I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of
y'all. Real quick. Just like this. What a
child. He will come,
y'all. Look. The main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police, like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavored Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087, this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old. And I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, He had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Okay, I jump off topic. It's open phone lines here, so we're going to open up the phone lines here momentarily, but we have a topic here, the rural jelly option. We talked a little bit about that yesterday. I'm going to go back into it a little bit more today, but we do have open phone lines here, so we got one more piece of motivation, which is like 2 minutes long, then we're going to go to the phone lines.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Okay, before we go to the phone lines here momentarily, The Royal Jelly option. Now, yesterday I bought it up. And Royal Jelly is something that is within the bee community. And let me break it down this way. When the queen bee lays her eggs, you have the two sexes, male and female, and for the first 3 days, well, matter of fact, let me put out the players in this. The queen bee, the drones, and the worker bees. Okay, those are the three primary characters in the beehive community. Once again, the queen is just one of them. Drones, worker bees. All right, what are the distinctions between the queen bee, the drones, and the worker bees? All right, typically in a beehive community, there's one queen. Her primary function is to lay eggs and repopulate the community. All right. Now, drones, and of course the queen bee is female. Drones are males. They're the male bees, and they mate with the appropriate queen bee. Worker bees are sterile female bees, and they help take care of, they produce the royal jelly that is fed to all bees, regardless of sex or caste system function, for the first, they take care of all the feeding. Now, when the larvae, when the eggs are hatched and the larvae, bee larvae is out there, for the first 3 days, across the board, the males who become drones and the females who become worker bees, and then there's some select who will become queen bees in their own nest. But every bee on the first 3 days of life receives the equal dosing of feeding of royal jelly. That's the food, that's the nutrient for the bee community. Now, after the third day, okay, now while this is going on, in addition, the worker bees, which are all female, but they're sterile females, because basically, matter of fact, let me break it down this way. Okay, I got to refer to my notes. Okay, let me see. Let me break it down this way. There's six different roles in the beehive community. The queen's only job is to lay eggs. The drone's job is to mate with the queen. Drones are males. Worker bees, which are strictly female, sterile females, worker bees are responsible for everything else. The worker bees gather the nectar. The worker bees are in charge of guarding the hive and the honey and caring for the queen and larvae and cleaning up the hive. And they're also, the worker bees, the female sterile bees, are also in charge of producing the honey. Very orderly. Very orderly. Okay. Now, during those first 3 days, you also have the worker bees that are also constructing special chambers within the hive for future queen bees. and they feed them more royal jelly. And due to the fact that they're getting more nutrition and getting fed more royal jelly, those female larvae, by getting the more nutrition of more royal jelly, they develop into sterile, fertile, because the worker bees are sterile. They develop into fertile females who become queen candidates to start another hive. All right, that's how it goes. I'm going to try to relate this the best I can to, well, what does this have to do with human beings? Well, the analogy I'm trying to paint here is, let's say royal jelly, when it comes to us humans, and by the way, you can go to a health food store and buy royal jelly. You know, they have health claims and all this, but we're not into that today. But royal jelly in reference into humans, us people, I'm going to refer it to education, an elite education, emphasis elite education and access to resources that the mainstream public doesn't have easy access to. Now, the analogy that I gave yesterday is typically in mainstream culture, you know, when you're approaching getting out of school in 12th grade or what have you, most people have about three options. Well, after you graduate from high school, or drop out from high school, either one, are you going to go get a job working for somebody else? Are you going to go into the military, which is a job working for somebody else, the government? Or are you going to go to college or university, study, get a degree to get a job to work for somebody else? And all three of those, the common denominator is you're working for somebody else. Now, generally speaking, on a critical mass basis, those are the three options that most people have been indoctrinated into believing. Now, royal jelly, there are royal jelly options that they take note of those three options. Here are four more options. After high school, or dropping out of school, whichever comes first, your family's going to train you on how to operate, run, and take over the family business. Donald Trump's children, I'm sure around that breakfast table, from the time he and his wife brought them home from the hospital, they weren't talking about you're going to go get a job working for somebody else. Donald Trump grew up in his father's business. His father was a builder. He came up learning the construction trades or the building trades. So I'm sure his children and his grandchildren, those three options are off the table. They're not going to go to work for somebody else. They're not going to go in the military. And if they go to college, which I'm sure they have, They're going to certain schools where there's what I call educational royal jelly, where you get access to information that's not being distributed at other schools. Matter of fact, let's look at this as a menu. You go to a restaurant, and the Trumps have one menu with items on it, and you're given another menu with items on it. So you're reading from two different menus. Now, so there's royal jelly as far as, you know, education. And then, you know, not to get on that level, you also have, you know, like, somebody that you might run into, an Asian that might own a gas station, and they have an auto body shop in there, or the auto mechanics. Their royal jelly is, we're owning gas stations. We're owning mechanic shops. Or if it's a carryout, which maybe, like, you know, I ordered some Chinese food last week from my usual spot. And that's a family-run business. But in that family-run business, more than likely, the ingredients that they're using in the food that they sell, the rice, the vegetables, that's more than likely connected to a farm system that they are a part of. So they're able to, they're not shopping at Walmart. They're not shopping at Whole Foods. They're not shopping at Giant, Safeway, Piggly Wiggly, Windex, your Web Kroger's, wherever you might go get, they're not shopping at those places. They grow their stuff. They're part of a cooperative that they own their own farms. They grow their own food, and it's a supply chain. And those children they are raised on the complete supply chain from. Growing from the seeds to the growing of the food to the trucking, the warehousing, to getting into the particular outlets, the retail outlets where the Chinese food, the egg foo young, the shrimp fried rice, the egg rolls, over 200 items on that menu. The menu that they have might have 200 or 300 paychecks on it, profit centers. The menu that the average person that goes to school, grades 1 through 12, your menu might have one or two items on it. More royal jelly, some people are raised and educated on, they're going to be running industries. And then another royal jelly education is, you're going to this particular school where you're going to go to school with children of diplomats and heads of states. Like in Washington, D.C., there's a school called Sitwell Friends. Sitwell Friends, children of diplomats, entrepreneurs, and heads of the state attend that school on Wisconsin Avenue in Washington, D.C. As I told you yesterday, the tuition for pre-K to second grade at that school is over $40,000 a year. It's that high of a tuition because you're getting access, the parents and the children are getting access to royal jelly, stuff that is not being offered in a regular public school anywhere in Washington, D.C., or anywhere around the D.C. Beltway area. And they have schools like this all over the world that offer this kind of what I call royal jelly. Now, you also have other communities like the Amish. The Amish go to academics, they go grades 1 through 8. After 8th grade, they're learning the family business, whatever that family business might be. Some Amish families are in the furniture, but they make furniture. Some make sheds. Some build houses. Some build tiny houses. Sunbelt, everything I just said. And that's on the dad's side of the family. On the mother's side of the family, they might have restaurants, thrift stores, clothing stores, shoe shop, bakeries that have all kind of baked goods. So that's their educational world, Jelly. And, you know, instead of going to 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, where you're reading books, writing book reports, memorizing stuff that you're going to forget and spit it back out on the test, and then you think you might go to Harvard or Yale business school. No, they're going to business school in 9th grade. They have a 4-year jump on any Ivy Leaguer business school person starting from 9th grade. So by the time they turn 17 or 18 or 19 or whatever, they're running, and some of these Amish families take in $5 million to $10 million a year. Many of them control towns. Just like 2-3 months ago, we had on here three young ladies from the Freedom Georgia Initiative. And it all generations are representative. Those children in that, in the Freedom Georgia Initiative, their world, Jelly, is their children are learning how to build a township from scratch. Even within that, part of that includes learning how to build your own house. So these are all examples of what I call world jelly education. Anyway, I'm going to cut it off from there. And let me find my way back to the studio. But, matter of fact, let me read you this. But concerning the Amish, matter of fact, you say the Amish, the Mennonite, and the Houdinites. Despite being an agrarian community, the Amish do value education highly. Now, mind you, they go to grades academically 1-8. They know it's necessary to teach their youth about farming, animal care, carpentry, and other skills necessary for their lifestyle. They are not the typical subjects that are taught in the curricula of conventional schools, but they are indeed relevant to the practical and practical within the Amish community, and Mennonite and Houdinite. Once again, in an Amish community, they're teaching their children house building, carpentry with those house building, how to grow your own food so you don't have to go shopping at Whole Foods or Kroger's or any place like that. They're teaching practical topics, hands-on. They're not taking any written tests. There's no multiple choice. They're getting hands-on instruction. If you go online and type in any search engine, Amish communities in the United States or Mennonite communities around the world or Houdinite communities, they're probably about 3 or 4 states in the United States, but they got a lot of them in Canada. Look up their communities. And see what they have. And also type in Yoder, Kansas. Yoder, Kansas. Yoder, Kansas is a predominantly Amish. They might have some Mennonite township. I think they only have 163 people there, but they have a community-based business. Native Americans, also many Native Americans, they have community-based businesses. It could be a casino, it could be a golf course, a combination of all of the above, or something else. You know, they have trucking businesses also. Even African Americans historically there's over 800, 900 African-American communities, many of them are over 100 years old. When they started out, they were basically communities that had a community-based business. They would grow things and sell them to other communities. And over 700 of those exist still to this day. Tuskegee University, which is in Tuskegee, Alabama, is an example of one of those. The community-based business that they had started with, and they still have it to this day, is education with Tuskegee University. That's one of the things that they were selling, education. But in any event, okay, so that's my rant on all that. I was trying to relate royal jelly from bees to us humans. If you're educated in the right and relevant things and practical things, you'll have a definite edge over other people. You know something that they don't know. And we can relate this to even empires, historical empires around the world. Okay, all right, let me find my way back to the studio here. It's open mic. Any guy thing you guys want to talk about, trending topics, building, which what I'm working on now, and I'm waiting on a call back. Radio isn't what it used to be, but there might be some strong radio stations out there that what I'm looking to do is with podcasts, it's a shotgun approach. You know, so you got people that will download this podcast that, I mean, we got listeners in Moscow, Southeast Asia, Brazil, Uganda. That's the shot kind of thing. But those people in all those cities I just named, they're not going to come to an event that we will have, let's say in Chicago, Orlando, Florida, St. Louis, Missouri, any place like that. So I'm in talks with some radio stations, and we're going to see if we can marry podcasts with local radio stations. So if we want to zero on in on a particular geographical market offline, we can have a critical mass of people. And I'm talking about give me 10 people, and we'll get 40 acres and put a little small community on there. So that's where we're in talks with that right now. All right, 309 area code, your mic is open. 309, mic's open. You might be on mute. Or he might have stepped away because he's always building something. So, all right, 309. I'm going to leave your mic open. Let's see. 262 area code, your mic is open.
Hi there, Grand Rising.
Grand Rising,
how are you?
How are you? Good.
I'm well, thank you. I really, really love, you know, the content that you share. You're certainly an educator. So the royal jelly is what I learned about today. I'm so excited. I did share a piece with my 22-year-old, and so we're getting ready to have a meeting, actually, about business. Because I just have to remind my sons, you know, you guys came up in that head. You know, retail businesses. It was instilled in me to be an entrepreneur and to build, and from gardening to, my dad was a three-area tradesman, carpenter, licensed journeyman, plumber, and electrician. So I certainly was aware.
Oh, no, Reba, share some more about your dad, because I remember you shared that with me when we met in Chicago. You share that with us because, well, that's royal jelly. What yeah. your dad did, those three professions was rural justice. So share that with us a little bit more.
So my dad, at the age of, by the age of 21, he owned like five properties paid for. And he was the first black engineer on the Dan Ryan Expressway. So he was certainly a builder. My grandfather, paternal grandfather, his dad was a master journeyman plumber as well. So it was supposed to be a tradition to have the males in the family become licensed plumbers, actually master journeyman plumbers. Nevertheless, my dad okay. did a lot of work on his property. He's also done a lot of work in the Bronzeville community of Chicago. He did a lot of general contracting work for seniors. My sister and I helped this elder woman to secure her floors. So we laid tile. My dad reset the foundation of her floor, and we laid tile. I remember walking up the stairs. My sister and I, my dad was like, be very careful. And so we trusted my dad because any other child would have probably, you know, a parent child probably would have threw those stairs, but he was going to rebuild her stairs as well. So in her house, we helped with the floor, but that was really, really interesting. And he explained, he said a lot of the seniors, a lot of times they don't have family that they not even they may not even, they certainly don't want to leave anything to their children. He was letting us know that we were giving them value by servicing these elders that he was helping because they couldn't afford, you know, like major contractors. And these were property owners, too, in the Brownsville area. So other than that, he actually, my dad, Robert Booth, I call him the Honorable, late Honorable Robert Booth, He started the and gave the full curriculum and structure of a construction program for inner city, what was the name of that organization? Chicago Black United Caucus was an entity under Lou Palmer, and who was a former radio personality on WVON, the talk of the town back then. So my dad implemented where the office was on 37th and Oakwood Boulevard. He implemented the construction program years ago, and he had the trainees. He created, you know, not only work opportunities, but a trade program for those young males there. Ex-offenders were welcome as well. So pretty much he was instrumental in helping to build the Bronzeville community of Chicago or sustain, you know, a lot of the properties there. He also was asked to encourage our late Mayor Harold Washington to run for mayor because he pretty much wasn't trying to do that. He probably knew the ills of the sector, but he did run, and actually, as we know, we well know that he won. He ran a great campaign for fresh, positive energy, and he was a great mayor. But my dad was not only an advisor to Lou Palmer, but Harold Washington as well, so. Yeah. Well, at least when he first got into office, my dad was a person that they asked to encourage then Senator Harold Washington to run for mayor.
Okay. Reba, now, up in the Chicagoland area, besides WVON, what stations – particularly on an AM dial, do you think people listen to up there?
1390, 1690, 1590. I would listen to WBEZ as well. Let me see. It was a few of them. So I don't listen as much, but I guess I will since you brought that back to remember. Because I would get up as I was getting ready for work when I was teaching at Little Black Pearl, the Art and Design Academy, I would listen to Steve Harvey and then it was GCI FM, but also opera.
Well, let me be more specific. What, like, what gospel stations do are still listened to up that way? I mean, because I rarely listen to radio myself. But what I'm looking for is, like I said, with the internet, it's a shotgun approach. What I'm looking for is something where I can laser beam a geographical area. So that's where radio still has an edge over the internet. If I want a local audience that I can meet, you know, I can't think of anything else right now other than radio to do it.
Right. Yeah, so that's Inspiration 1390, WGRB. So WZON, that was actually still so that's the gospel radio station. And that was where Talk of the Town was. For gospel AM, that's what most people would listen to.
Right, what was those call letters again?
WGRB.
Okay.
So, of course, now it's
GRB,
online.
I found it.
Yeah, it was black owned run, and it was actually bought out. Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. I hope iHeart didn't buy out. I'm looking at, let's see, on air. Well, let me look at the Wikipedia page if they have one. Yep, iHeart Radio bought them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah, and so Purvis Spann and his
Which
daughter
means
Melody.
If iHeart bought them, more than likely they're probably automated.
Yeah, they have online now, yeah.
No, and what I mean by automated is they've taken the human, they've taken a lot of the human element out of the station.
Gotcha. Well, you mean just to play a music album?
Yeah, WVON is, WVON is probably, you get real people around the clock.
Mm-hmm.
Hold it. Don't tell me they bought WVON.
1690.
Okay, WVON 1690. Yeah, iHeart bought them too. Yeah, I'm trying to stay away from iHeart because iHeart automates a lot of stuff. So, and you're not getting local people. You might, like for instance, Steve Harvey's on a lot of stuff. I mean, Steve Harvey, Monique, and all those people. And I play Steve Harvey on here every day. But Steve Harvey, more than likely, you're not going to see him in Chicago on a weekly basis or a daily basis. So I'm trying to marry the podcast into a local station that has local personnel, and you have that local audience that you can meet face-to-face. So.
Is one on the southeast side of Chicago. I drove past there, and I drive past there from time to time. And I'm thinking that, I don't know if that's, I don't remember the call letter. But we have WMBI 1110 AM. I'm not familiar with that one, but I see it here. WCSN. 8:20 a.m. And certainly, like you said, so songs have closing. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, iHeart, another station, but they've gone in and they've corporatized a lot of these. Well, practical verbs used to be mom and pop stations, and you know they'll put on, like say somebody like a Steve, a nationally known personality, but the nationally known personality, and what they've done is, they've replaced the local advertiser, like name some local, business in the like. What's a famous, a well-known black-owned restaurant in Chicago?
Black-owned. I was just driving past DJ's Market. There was one on 79th and Racine, on the corner of 79th and Racine, and they had another site. I don't know if they're still open, but they were pretty popular. So Jerk 48, black-owned.
Right, yeah, a lot of, and Chicago's got a lot of businesses that have been there for a long time. Like, I'll give an example. Like in Washington, D.C., Ben's Chili Bowl. Ben's Chili Bowl has been around for a long time in D.C. And at one time, for years, they just had their one location, but they advertised on WOL. Okay. And probably maybe WYCB, too. And the bulk of the advertising that sustained WOL and WYCB for decades was the local advertiser. Now, when somebody like iHeart comes in, they eliminate the local advertiser for the most part, and they bring on the national advertiser like McDonald's, Burger King, Coca-Cola, you know, whoever what. And what I'm looking for are local stations with a dedicated, loyal listenership, because, like I say, those are the ones where I can get traction with, so to speak. But like I say, I mean, Steve Harvey's on God knows how many stations. When Rush Limbaugh was living, he was on, I don't know, at least 500 stations. But Rush Limbaugh's not making, you're not going to physically see him in 499 of those markets. So I'm looking for stations where you have local personalities that get out into the community, and you have local advertisers who basically support that station with their advertising. So,
well, I don't really want to, I'm a little bit upset with. Yeah, Terry Bishop is the accounts executive over there at WBON, so he does solicit to black businesses. Harold's Chicken is one that's always had, like, a presence in the black community. Harold's Chicken, people who travel back to Chicago just for that chicken. So that's one.
Right.
Leon.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure Chicago's got a bunch of So, you know what? The late Don Cornelius, he started right at WVON. You know, then he had, you know, because Soul Train started out as a little after-school dance show in Chicago, and then it started to get some momentum, and he went out to California. But, yeah, WVON back in the day, I don't know how they support it now advertising-wise. I know iHeart brings in a lot of national advertising. But VON through the years, before I bought them, you know, was sustained by a lot of local businesses right in Chicago. And, you know, VON's still widely listened to. Because I can listen to VON on my phone here in Florida. Mm-hmm. So VON's still well listened to. But I just want to see whatever options are up in that city. When I want to do a build, we want to basically use local advertising, and the way I want to do it is we'll have a local talk show out of Chicago. In other words, it's my house, Chicago. It's my house, Chicago. But the difference is, you know, we can meet Reba at this particular location where we'll be building. In other words, what's today, Wednesday? So let's say we get an hour talk show or a half-hour talk show with It's My House Chicago on whatever station up in Chicago. And people are still hearing online, but you can meet Reba where you can get you can participate hands-on in building tomorrow, Thursday, at such and such location. So that's the general idea of where I want to go with
this. Yeah, and that was really what had the people in the community engaged. It was awesome. You knew where to be, and you would meet those personalities. You know, it was like family. Like, I just met. So I knew I was Daryl Dennard, who was on, I want to say BET. He was on, what was that show? Was it BET before Donnie Simpson? What was that show that Donnie Simpson was on?
Man, you're going way back in the time machine on that one. I couldn't tell
Donnie
you.
Simpson. Well, it became Video Soul. He did Video Soul.
I know you're talking about.
Morning show. He did a morning show. He's 69 years old. Didn't know that.
Yeah, you're going back on the time machine on that.
Because it was on TV. But anyway, Daryl Dennard was my instructor at Kennedy King. So back to WVON. The general manager's daughter, actually, I had a meeting with her because there was a Wesley South commemoration, who is a legend in the broadcast community. So the day that I actually was at the commemoration event with my dad, my dad, which he was always pretty, you know, wise to say, like, make this move, make that move. So we sat there and we talked. He wanted me to raise my hand. I raised my hand. He said, what do you want to ask? He said, make sure that it's something that would connect you with, you know, he said, we want to reach out to the young people. You're young. I was 19. So he had me to ask if they had anything that was geared towards the younger generation. Well, they didn't at the time. So my idea was to, I think I was asked, well, do you have any ideas? I said, well, maybe is it possible that we could have a youth broadcasting program, radio broadcasting program to engage the youth. So I ended up meeting with Melody Spann at the time. She had just been promoted to general manager of WVON. And she had seen that I had business knowledge, but I didn't have radio production knowledge. So she is the one who sent me back to college. She was like, well, take a couple of classes Kennedy King is a good spot. So Daryl Dennard was there. Jean Sparrow, so she's pretty popular as a personality here in Chicago. I've heard from her soon. She was an instructor over there. But Daryl Dennard was one of my instructors. I met her. But I recently just met Irene Mojica, yeah. And I didn't know, so she's so down to earth. So she's actually on WGCI, though, by the way. Well, she was. Now she's on WCSU, Chicago State University as a radio station. So, yeah, pretty interesting that I've connected with some of the popular. And Daryl Dennard was also on, it was Ebony Jet Showcase, right? Remember that?
Uh-huh. Oh, I remember that.
Daryl Dennard used to, I've got to reconnect with him. I hope he's well. You remember Know Your Heritage, that show with the young people?
I probably saw it, but can't remember by the name, but yeah.
It was an academic competition where they win money for the school and so forth. So he hosted that as well. Daryl Dennard hosted that every year. Know Your Heritage. We need to bring that stuff back for real. So, yeah.
Okay.
Awesome.
see. All right, so, Chris Collins, you there yet? I left your mic open. Or he still might be.
Well, I don't think I got a chance to.
Oh, okay, yeah, Chris, I had opened your mic, but you were off. You were doing something.
Yeah, I'm over at a job site, and I had to be on mute, and there was probably a banging noise that I didn't hear.
Hi, Chris. We missed you at the event. It turned out really nice. We missed you.
Yes, I'm sorry that I couldn't be there.
Oh, it's okay. I feel that you have given some support along the way, and we appreciate it.
Oh, definitely. I'll always support you, Reba.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, now you had somebody on earlier, but she probably had to go. I think she had somebody on earlier. Somebody
yeah,
from Miami, Chris?
Yeah, I had Siva, my publicist that was done the Miami Art Fair, you know, and she just got done with the Super Bowl and the Grammys. But she's working with some people that's already done this launch across the country. And when we ended our show yesterday, we were going to talk about, you know, how do we impact the community and get, you know, 50 or 75 people doing something. And, I had her, you know, wanted to see about pulling her in. Along with,
okay, now she's,
you know,
physically in Miami.
No, she's in Chicago right now.
Oh, okay, Chicago. All right. Well, we got some people boots on the ground. Reba's one of them in Chicago. So I guess we can organize there, and then. I'm kind of pulling some people in the Orlando area as well. So, like Chris is still working there. Okay, so we need to reschedule that event. Go ahead, Chris, you were saying?
I was just going to say about what happened. I got a phone call this morning where I was working toward recycling all the material from the flood in Kentucky. And then the federal government came in and they seized all the material. And it put a stop to things. And the city wasn't necessarily wanting their FEMA trailers. They wanted something better. And we were offering something better. So I was working with all the mayors and everybody in the cities to do this, and we had land, and we were starting to get things moving, and it all had changed. So they wound up getting a hold of me today, and they said that they had lost 1,500 homes over three counties. They haven't built any of them back. They're working on securing the land and stuff to start building them, but they're interested in our housing method. So that came back on the table again today.
Well, you said now they came in and seized materials?
Yeah, we were going to take it to this industrial park and then separate all the recycling material and stuff and start, you know, getting it processed and stuff so we could build buildable material and build these people, you know, give them a purpose and a reason what's going on as they're getting their life back together. And the state and federal government came in and put a halt to it and started, they just came in and claimed all the material. They were taking over the control of what was going on with the cleanup, because these cities were doing you know, they were doing a lot, but they were all listening and wanting to build green. You know, they were all looking at every little aspect of it, and they were loving it. And, yeah, it pretty much all the material came to a halt, and we just stopped.
Oh, this was a government project? I mean, government-funded project anyway? Or government had something to do with it?
Not necessarily, but it was a natural disaster that just happened in Kentucky.
Okay.
Kentucky just got flooded last year, and I got brought in to and started working the disaster, and then we started talking about bringing in material and start building homes, and that's when everything changed. But as far as the city governments, you know, every one of the phone numbers I got for all the mayors and everybody, and you know, they're all good and on it. You know, they were all for it and still are, because like I said, they want me to send them an email and see about getting in and start sending house packages. So not just little tiny homes. We're talking about 1,500, 2,000 square foot houses.
Yeah, 2,000 square feet, that's a lot of house. But some people have houses twice that. 4,000 square foot house is big, but that's a dream home for some people. Yeah, that's very big.
I had a 3,000 square foot house that I put a 3,000 square foot addition and made a second floor out of it. But you know, I utilized it for doing things for my employees, because, you know, how big the yard was. I had a pool, I had a pond in the yard, and, you know, I'd bring them out, and then if nothing else, we would all take off on all the other stuff and go and play and do, you know, and just forget about what's going on in the world and enjoy. But that was short-lived. Mother Nature, you know, you never know when it's going to happen, but right in the middle of construction over one part that was already completed, and that was the kitchen and the family area, they had tore the roof off to do the second story addition, and we got about 14 inches of snow in on all the new kitchen cabinets and everything else. So about $60,000 damage. And then I wound up just basically losing everything after that direction. So that, you know, you can have those things. Of course, I didn't need that big of a house. I just got a deal on it. I bought a 3,000 square foot house for $113,000.
Okay.
In the middle of a subdivision. You know, it's kind of hard to turn that down.
That was a good deal. So with those larger homes, were they going to, like, have the state fund room for individuals homeless? So
those are family homes.
Okay. Oh, to rebuild them. Okay.
Yeah, these are rebuilding the homes that were lost flood. It's three counties, and there was 1,500 homes total that were totally lost. So, yeah, I just wound up getting the figures and stuff to that today. But, you know, the best part was is I've been out of sight, but I haven't been out of mind, because they brought it up today. And they're looking to start moving to do something, and that would be a good thing. I mean, I'm just there to help if I can. So
excellent. So nice.
Okay. Well, we gotta. Oh, are we gonna have a room today? You know, on Clubhouse.
Yes, there will be a room today. I was trying to figure out how to work what he gave me, and I'm gonna understand it all and get it open.
Yeah, I still haven't figured out those rooms yet. I mean, hold it. Those houses. Because with those houses,
yeah,
you got different rooms. I haven't figured that out yet.
I haven't either. This one here is just the Pete Cohen house. It's called Stop One, Start One.
And I went and met yesterday, and nobody was in there when I went in at 6 o'clock. They were a little bit after 6.
Yeah, that was all me. It was all my fault. Hopefully there'll be people in there today. If not, once it opens up and people and we've got it going, the people. So.
Now you know what it.
That was all on me yesterday. Though,
what I like about Clubhouse. And there are other audio apps besides Clubhouse, but I think Clubhouse is the king of the hill right now. I believe Clubhouse can replace, well, maybe not totally replace it, but put a significant dent in radio listenership. The smartphone is the new transistor radio. So essentially, you can program Clubhouse, which is an audio app, just like any radio station, without the commercials. So, and you can do it on a local. Well, you can do it locally, or you can do it, you know, regionally or internationally, any kind of way you want to do it. But anyway, that's the way I see it. Let's see. Let's go to area code 314. Your mic is open. 314, mic open.
LA, did you get that email I sent you?
Okay, hold on. Let me go check right now. Let's see.
The one I...
Yep. 902
AM. About the NAACP.
Benjamin Jealous. Oh, that was another email.
And I got some words in there, some paragraphs in there that's highlighted.
All right, I'm going to the highlighted one. The first one. As a lifelong activist, he was known in... Okay, I'm listening.
Yeah, this guy was the head of the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to show you how, why come stuff don't, why you have all these pull this way, pull that way that goes on. In black society, which really ain't no different than any other, but you remember the story that they had about Sherry Sherrod when Obama was president and she was an employee with USDA?
I vaguely recall the name, but not the story.
Well, Obama fired her before getting the detail because somebody said that she was being a racist. This is a black woman, by the way. They say, as a lifelong activist, they talk about Jealous. Jealous is not black. I mean, you can see his pictures, see that. But as a lifelong activist, he was known in the civil rights community, but not by the general public. Then he went on and said, over the years, he changed that, appearing in public constantly, often alongside other civil rights leaders. If there was a major regional, national civil rights event, Jealous was also there with rolled up sleeves. Now, he has had his bumps too. In 2010, he was faced criticism when he condemned a black USD employee, Shirley Sherrod, as a deceptively edited video appeared to show her making biased remarks about her work with a white farmer. Sheriff Cummins was actually part of a longer speech in which she discussed overcoming her prejudice. So what they accused of her doing was just not true. Okay. Then he was a graduate, becoming a Rhodes Scholar and earning a degree from Oxford. He worked in an investigative reporter for Mississippi Jackson Advocate and was founding director of Amnesty International Human Rights Program. Now, the thing that I asked you, that's kind of peculiar for somebody to be a member of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of the Colored People, to even have those credentials.
Yeah.
You see? Then it went on down next one when the thing on issue on Trayvon Martin. Have you had a chance to look at the Trayvon Martin hoax?
No, I haven't.
Well, you should look at that so you can see how the investigative reporter took over 40,000 pages of telephone records and showed that the witness that they had on the stand was not the person that he was talking to on the phone. And it showed how Benjamin Crump even said that he pushed this woman, Janelle, into doing what she was doing. She couldn't read and write, and she admitted that what she was doing was a fake. And they had her on the, they had her as a testimonial witness trying to convict George Zimmerman. So check that document out.
There's some videos on that too. We'll cover it. The Trayvon Martin hoax.
Then it goes down and talks about James Van Jones. Now, check this out. James Van Jones, you know who he was, host of CNN's Crossfire and former Obama Green Jobs advisor, said he has known Jello since they were student activists, Jones at Yale Law School and Jello at Columbia undergrad. Jones said he liked the fact that the product of a plan the NAACP pushed years ago to, and check this out, to steer Black Americans toward elite educational institution has helped return the organization to relevance. What elite educational institutions are they talking about, L.A.?
I don't know. I don't know.
Could we agree on, you know, it ain't no historical Black colleges and universities, right?
Typically, when you mention elite universities, that HBCUs don't come into that conversation, typically.
That's what it says here in the article, that Van Jones was glad, happy of jealous because of a plan the NAACP pushed years ago to steer Black Americans toward elite educational institution. Down in the other highlights,
typically when they say elite, because my definition of elite has changed education, but typically when a lot of people mention the term elite in a mainstream conversation, they're talking about the Ivy League, you know, Harvard, Yale, they might even throw in Stanford on the West Coast.
Right.
Yeah, well,
Yeah, it says right there that Jones came from Yale Law School, right?
Yeah, that's considered an elite school.
From Columbia. They're not historical Black colleges. And you know, it's a funny thing that the NAACP has a scholarship which is uses the slogan, a mind is a terrible thing to waste, right?
Yeah.
So what schools are they trying to steer black students to? It must not be these historical black colleges and universities. That kind of goes against the grain, but they have been known to do that. Another thing here.
Now, Piyaki, some might consider, it depends on who you talk to, some might consider Howard University and Morehouse elite. Depends on who you talk to.
Well, Morehouse and Howard are probably, they are probably two of five, I get this, who have a graduation rate above 50%. But in 6 years, L.A., not four. So what is the equation of the tuition expense if it takes you 6 years rather than four? How much more are you paying?
You're paying more.
You're paying 50% more. And that equates to what? 50% more, that's going to equate to a larger student loan, right?
Yeah, with most of those students
had loans. It says here in the next one, other civil rights leaders credit Jealous for reaching out beyond the groups that have traditionally worked with the NAACP and stretching old boundaries. Chad Griffin, president of the Human Rights Campaign, a group that advocates for what, L.A.?
Advocates, repeat that again.
Down under the article, highlighted by Van Jones, we enter into another bit of information here. We had this other civil rights leader that Jealous reached out to, and he was praising him. This guy's name is Chad Griffin. What does it say about Chad Griffin?
Fred, I'm scrolling now. Chad Griffin, president of the Human Rights Campaign, a group that advocates for gay and lesbian rights, said that when he assumed his role a little more than a year ago, Ben Jealous reached out and met me and met with him on his first day on the job. Jealous was insistent that both groups work together. And Griffin credits Jealous with pushing the marriage equality measures that have been passed in recent years, as well as strengthening the previously weak activist ties between the black and lesbian and gay communities.
All right. Now, what's been the complaint we've been hearing? Is that you got these groups that's riding in on the back of civil rights. You got these groups that's targeting black culture, and so on, so on, so on, so on. And then you got this organization, the NAACP, is pushing for marriage equality. In other words, it means that men can marry men and women can marry women. I mean, is that what you read?
That's what it seems like to me in this paragraph that I read.
So what I'm saying is this. Here you got this organization, which is supposed to be a spokesperson for black people. They're always in the news, always having the microphone put in their face, making really ridiculous statements like putting out a national travel ban for people traveling to Missouri, through Missouri, saying they have to be where they're saying black, really. Black people traveling through Missouri have to beware because you stand a likely chance of being killed by a white police officer. That's what they put out. But on the other hand, they are doing these other things that you know is not popular amongst blacks in America. So how is it that you can ever make progress in any one direction when you have these type of underhandedness going on? This group is against school choice. is directed by teachers unions, just like this candidate for mayor, Brandon, in Chicago. He's pushed by the teachers unions. The teachers unions want the status quo to remain in the school system. What was the report in Chicago's public schools here just maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago? That none of the schools, 50 schools, high school, none of the students was reading at high school level, nor doing math.
That's the same as in Baltimore. They have horrible test results as well.
And I think the NAACP national headquarters in Baltimore, if I'm not mistaken. So what I'm saying is this. When you got this organization here that's being set up, and they, I don't even know how they survive. They only got a 20-some-odd million-dollar a year budget. They got no people that make more than that on retirement. But you got this organization here that's being put in front as the national spokesperson for black people. They always go to, they run to. And look at the things that they stand for. They stand for the thing, basically what Du Bois said back early on in the early part of the 19th century, why he left the organization. Because the organization has policies that would otherwise continue to lead you into a state of subservience and dependency. You can't say that not being able to get a substantial education, you can't say that you can't read at the poll. You can't even vote properly if you can't read at grade level. How the hell can you interpret what the ballot issue is? How can you decipher? How can you analytically understand what ballot issues are if you can't read? Now, if you can't read and you participate in an activity like voting, then what does that mean? That means that you are being coerced, you are being directed in your actions when you go into that voting booth on who to vote for and how to vote. I mean, does that make sense to you? I mean, can you see that?
Yeah, well, right. If you, well, like I say, the same thing's happening in Baltimore. You're right. So if you can't read properly, and when I was in the D.C. school system as a teacher, yeah, quite a few of those, depends on what school you were at, though, that were 10th, 11th, 12th graders could barely read. I'll put it that way. It wasn't totally a wash, but they could barely read. Now, Reba, you know, Reba, you still there? Go ahead, Lupianki.
Then the last highlight, I think it is, it says Mary K. Henry, International President of the Service Employees International Union. Now we're starting to talk about who? Immigrants coming into the country. Said Jealous helped expand what's considered the civil rights agenda from the expected voting rights and death penalty cases to issues surrounding the closure of dangerous power plants, early childhood education, and health care. So you got to get out of, apparently, what's not carrying, towing the bell into other areas as they associate with other ethnic groups. Now what you've done is you watered down what was supposed to have been solely for one. Now you got to share it with others. That's why kind of shit don't never get done. Whether it's good or bad, that's a whole different discussion. Because you got all this tugging and pulling going on. You got over 150 separate organizations in this country, black organizations in this country, that want to separate. 150. Including the Nation of Islam. And you could probably name two or three of them yourself. But damn, it's 150? Holy cow. That's why nothing ever gets done, Italy.
Well, I was looking at some stats earlier this morning. Canada, there's 38 million, something like, I'm going to say 38 million, it might be less than that, but let's say 38 million people total that live. Canada has a larger landmass than the United States. And there are more African Americans in this country than the entire nation of Canada. I'll figure out something with that later, but I thought that was interesting. So,
well, yeah,
however,
you got,
like you said, you have a lot of divided groups, subgroups within, you know.
I sent you another map showing the 11 nations that the United States consists of. Did you get a chance to look at that?
Yeah, look, matter of fact, we talked about it last week, I think, a little bit. Yeah.
Absolutely. This country, U.S., is divided in about 11 different cultures that can be considered nations. From New France and New Orleans all the way up to the large swath of area called New France up at the Canadian-American border, which goes all the way back to the wars, battles that was held on the Great Lakes. Then you got Yankeedom, which would be the East Coast, consisting of your Carolinas and your New Yorks, and possibly part of Massachusetts and that. You got that area up there in the northeast corner. Then you got that area way over in the northwest corner, your Oregon, Washington. Matter of fact, you got counties in Oregon that's talking about seceding and joining on to who? Idaho, I think it is.
Yeah, Idaho. Well, then you even have some people, now this has been going on for a while, they don't get much publicity, but some Californians would like to see California divided into three states, North California, South Carolina, and Central California. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but you're right. Oregon,
South Carolina, part of
Oregon wants to succeed into Idaho, I believe.
And I think that, you know, looking at the rest of Oregon and the politics, you have to ask yourself, how in the world did the politics go so wrong in a state like Oregon, where you have a governor that claimed that Mao is racist. And now they say that a student does not have to show Mao proficiency to graduate. And hell, in some towns up there, you'd be lucky if you can find 10 black people in that state.
In Oregon.
So something.
Well, for the most part, and Chris Rock said this years ago, really, black folks in the United States are really just in a handful of locations. Because if you go to, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, I mean, even in the state of Pennsylvania, once you get outside of Philadelphia and, Pittsburgh, it's basically a white state. The Dakotas, Montana, Oregon, Washington State.
That's called a far west.
Once you get outside of Seattle and Spokane, Washington State is mostly white. The United States is 75% white. So essentially, most blacks are really just huddled into a handful of cities. Because there's over 19,000 of them in the country. So most places, are you're not going to see that many, too many black folks.
You know, one of the larger areas is, and I made a mistake when I included in Carolina being in Yankeedom. Actually, Yankeedom starts up above around New York. Then you got New Netherlands that's right beneath it that runs down into your Virginia. Then you got the Tidewater area, which would include like Maryland and so forth. You got the Deep South, which is a large span of area. It runs all the way up to the Boot Hills of Missouri at the bottom of Illinois. But I didn't know that Illinois could be considered as being in what's called Greater Appalachia. That's a new one.
I remember Illinois being in that, but yeah, Greater Appalachia is pretty expansive. But yeah, and well, all right, Appalachia, right? Appalachia, when I'm thinking about Appalachia, because Appalachia is a pretty big region, because West Virginia sticks out in my mind. West Virginia and Flint, Michigan. I don't know if not many people have been to Flint, Michigan, but you know, there's a lot of Flint, Michigans, where you just see, well, put it this way, the TV show Roseanne, it's the Connors now, I think that show was probably because essentially Roseanne, in my opinion, represents the United States of America. We're talking about blue collar folks that, you know, work the 9-to-5 and sometimes they're struggling and sometimes they're not.
Well, your Yankeedom would consist of areas west of the Great Lakes, encompassing the Great Lakes, Great Lake Superior, and so on. Of course, that would be your Minnesota and your Massachusetts, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Minnesota, your Michigan. And then your Yankeedom would also come over to what we know as being the mid and upper Northeast, Connecticut, and quite natural, you know, I mean, if you think about it, Boston. Then above that, you got your new friends going up into Canada. The Midlands, they call it. You got the Midlands, once again, right below what you call Yankeedom, as we mentioned about Minnesota. And your Wisconsin and your Michigan, which would curtail your Missouri and upper Boot Hill of Missouri. So these people think differently. And if you ever been in those areas, like down at the tip of Florida, which is called the Spanish Caribbean, those are the people that you run into. You can notice the difference, of course, in the accent and the traditional celebrations that they have. I mean, it's different. The southern tip of Texas, across the New Mexico, and there you're talking about what they call El Dorte.
You know, I'm looking at a map. Something you just mentioned a few minutes ago, Greater Appalachia. You're right. The state of Illinois, it looks like practically half of the state of Illinois is in Greater Appalachia.
So those are different people. Those are different cultures. They don't think the same.
Yeah, different cultures.
We know that the people down there in Florida who have death penalty, then you go up there and you're in your Yankeedom, your Massachusetts, Boston, Massachusetts, go up in your Connecticut, your Vermont, they have a different perspective about the death penalty. So anyway, I just wanted to bring it out, especially about the NAACP.
Yeah, Greater Appalachia,
pretty big.
There's a lot to that. Okay.
It covers a whole lot of territory.
It sure does. I'm looking at it. It goes all out west to west, New Mexico. It covers probably about 70% of Texas. It covers most of, Oklahoma, caused a good part of, well, a noticeable part of, what do you call it, Kansas, in Missouri,
yeah.
Arkansas. Like I say, it looks like about half of, let's see, what do you call it, Illinois. Indiana, Ohio, all of Kentucky, all of West Virginia, about 8% of Tennessee. Boy, it's massive. I'm gonna have to use this map for other podcasts.
Okay, LA, I just want to point that out.
Okay. Yeah, Appalachia, you got some struggling people. You got some struggling people in that part of the country.
Yeah, in some areas of it, yes, you're right.
Some area.
Sarah Huckabee is the governor of Arkansas, isn't she? Yes, I think it's Arkansas, yeah.
Oh, what you said, Sarah Huckabee or Mike Huckabee?
Sarah. Sarah was elected governor.
I
think she's going to do a damn good job. I think she's probably looking at a presidential contender one of these days out of her.
Oh, all right. Since she's a presidential contender, right, Nikki Haley's turning her hat. DeSantis, has, to my knowledge, has not officially announced. But he has released a book, which usually is, you know, prelim. So Trump
now they're starting
announced.
To find out a lot of stuff, too, after a period of time. Like I say, don't forget to look at the Trayvon Martin hoax, please. And email me, text me on what your thoughts are. When investigative reporters, and also look how they made Obama's statement and how they really just bamboozling these people, man. That's what they doing. People making money off this stuff, and they black. Black folks is making money off of these fights. From the Al Sharptons on down to Jesse Jackson, they all are. We already know that, but it even goes further than them. And you look at the names. But anyway.
Kath, you will probably be one of those names.
Well,
right,
yeah,
well,
because
we'll cover that. I'm going to read that in the Trayvon Martin hoax and get back to you on that. And
all right, well,
now,
I'll let you get on off your show, man, so you can save money.
Okay. I appreciate the information, Bianchi. Now, tomorrow, everybody, talk to you tomorrow. Tomorrow, people, on Thursdays, we don't do the 10:30 thing because I got invited by a mayor to sit in on they have a conference of mayors, and particularly the townships I like to go buy land in, so. On Thursdays, we're on for just 30 minutes, and that's in the afternoon, Eastern Standard Time, 4:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. That's on Thursday. Now, on Friday, we're back on, our regular 10:30 Eastern Standard Time. So tomorrow, like I said, 4:30, Thursdays only, 4:30 to 5:30, and we're not on in the mornings, but Friday, we're back to regular hours. Any announcements from anybody before we sign off for the day? We got about 2 minutes left in regular time. We're not really going to go overtime today. On anything that's come up, including the royal jelly, and when I say royal jelly in the context I was talking about today, I was relating it to education. And my definition of elite schools, I've reframed my whole thing on education. Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Cornell, Brandeis, all those, that my definition of when it comes to a university setting, now, originally when Booker T. Washington was available, Tuskegee Institute, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, when he was living, not now, is Tuskegee University now, but when Booker T. Washington was alive, Tuskegee Institute, in my opinion, was an elite school of higher learning. And here's why I'm saying that. They started off with a shack. Their first classroom was a shed or a shack. They taught the students, and I guess we are going in overtime because I'm not going off the air right now. I'm giving my definition, what I consider higher learning. And it's not Princeton, Yale, and all those other places. With Tuskegee Institute, when Booker T. Washington was alive, those students had to learn academics as well as industrial or building trades. They learned how to make bricks. And they built those early buildings at Tuskegee. Those students built that. That was part of their education. That's what I called an elite education. It was practical. They built buildings. They made their own bricks, and they were horrible at it at first, but they learned how, they became good manufacturers of bricks. So good that their primary customers were people in the county, which were white folks, who bought those bricks. And they bought those bricks because they made a superior product. They also learned how to make nails. So they made their own building. They made part of their own building materials, bricks, nails, and they built those first buildings at Tuskegee. This is all done when Booker T. Washington was alive. Now, one of the things that he was fighting against parents with at that time, the parents of these students wanted their kids to get more book learning in the classroom. They didn't see the value of the building trades, manual labor, and that type of thing. Today we would call them building technologies. So now they've gotten away from that. So I wouldn't include Tuskegee. You know what? I got an asterisk by that one because they did participate in an event some years ago called the Soul of Decathlon, where they had to actually build a off-the-grid house on the grounds of the Washington Monument. So I'm going to put an asterisk by them as a possible elite school of higher education. But Harvard, Yale, Princeton, they're not on my list of elite schools. Union shops that take students from high school and teach them a trade. It could be electrical, it could be plumbing, it could be house building. I consider those schools elite schools. Unions that have their own schools, I consider them. Matter of fact, I'd rather go to a union shop school as an apprentice than anything at Harvard and Yale. Because at Harvard and Yale, and that's a whole nother atmosphere. When you're going to Harvard and Yale, you're getting access to, because you got to look at why you're going to a particular school. So people that might be going to an Ivy League school, they're looking for possible social contacts that might have inroads to whatever, because, Bill Gates went to Harvard for, maybe a year. He dropped out. Now, I don't know who he met in that year, And then, what's his name? the Facebook guy, Mark Zuckerberg. He went to Harvard for, what, a semester, dropped out. Now, those are two billionaires. They didn't become billionaires from anything they learned in any book or any class at Harvard. But maybe it's somebody that they met. Well, Zuckerberg definitely did. The Winklevoss twins. So, like I said, when you go to Harvard, it all depends on, you're not going there for the academics. You're going there for access to people for whatever endeavor that you want or industry that you might want to get into. So, all right, Harvard, I'll give you an asterisk. All right. But I would, but it all depends on what you want to do or what you want access to. But I would call union shops, trade schools, elite schools. Because you got doctors, I mean, you got plumbers out here that make more than doctors. Let's see. Oh. Amish, they go grades 1 through 8, and after that, they learn the family business. I would call, in Amish community, I call their education elite. Because they're learning something that they can immediately turn into dollars and cents. The same goes for Mennonites. And if you want to get into the communal living, that's when the Hutterite, where, I mean, they're buying 20 acres, 30 acres, 50 acres, 100 acres, make that 10,000 acres of land, 20,000 acres of land. But the way they do it in the Hutterite community, which is similar to the Amish community and the Mennonite community, what they do is essentially it's communal living. Whereas with the Amish and the Mennonites, it's more entrepreneurial on, you know, family fortunes can differ from family to family. Depends on what they want to do. All right. So those are my ideas of, and then you know what? You can get an elite education on YouTube. I'm not talking about academic, because you have YouTubers, I mean, in their 20s, some in their early 30s that have paid off their parents' home, paid off the mortgage by just doing YouTube videos. I would call that, whatever they're doing to do that, because I don't know how to do that yet, that's an elite education that they got off of YouTube. And you can learn how to, it's a whole lot you can learn on YouTube. So I consider YouTube a platform where you can gain an elite education for whatever you pay for your monthly internet bill. So, all right, tomorrow, we're not on in the morning. We're on from 4 to 4:30 p.m., just for 30 minutes, and then Friday we're back at our regular time. Because like I said, tomorrow I have to do the mayor thing, and that takes about 2 to 3 hours with that alone. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.